From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Tonight, on the final night of the Democratic National Convention, Joe Biden will accept his party's presidential nomination and lay out why he thinks he should be elected. Some of his former primary rivals will also speak, including Cory Booker, Pete Buttigieg, Andrew Yang, and Michael Bloomberg. In a speech last night, the vice presidential nominee, Kamala Harris, made history as the first black woman on a major party ticket. She told her story of growing up as the child of immigrants and said the country is at an inflection point.
The constant chaos leaves us adrift. The incompetence makes us feel afraid. The callousness makes us feel alone. It's a lot. And here's the thing, we can do better and deserve so much more.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving joins us now. Ron, let's start with Kamala Harris, an historic moment just to have her up there on that stage in that position last night. What did she accomplish with her speech?
She showed herself to be a communicator of the first order for our age, Jeremy. She was able to hold a TV audience without the support of a cheering throng of fanatics like we usually see at the conventions. Mm-hmm. And she showed why Biden chose her, and she sent a signal to those who still feel neglected in this party that the future is not just coming, it is arriving. And with Kamala Harris, it's here.
Her speech followed one by former President Obama, who called President Trump a threat to democracy for trying to undermine mail-in voting in the post office. Listen.
This administration has shown it will tear our democracy down if that's what it takes for them to win. So we have to get busy building it up by pouring all our efforts into these 76 days and by voting like never before.
Now, Ron, you've watched a lot of conventions over the years. Some people may not have seen as many, but this was very unusual to have a former president go after his incumbent successor in that way.
Yes, times have changed, Jeremy. The old rules no longer seem to apply. And in the past, when presidents came to a convention, they basically were there for staying above the fray, being very presidential. They were a nostalgia note, maybe some bittersweet faded glory in some cases. But Obama was very much in the fray, arguably the point man on the attack. It's fair to say, though, if the tone and the rules of American politics have changed in recent years, it wasn't Obama who changed them.
Mm-hmm. What does Biden have to do tonight? Who does he need to speak to and appeal to in his speech?
He needs to show that he is worthy of all the praise that he's had heaped upon him all week by all the different people who have talked. He needs to show some of that decency we keep hearing about, the compassion. And he needs to show he can still bring it, Jeremy. He needs to give a strong speech and dispel doubts about his energy and acuity.
Hillary Clinton also spoke last night and warned about President Trump. Listen to this.
And don't forget, Joe and Kamala can win by 3 million votes and still lose. Take it from me. So we need numbers overwhelming so Trump can't sneak or steal his way to victory.
Now, Hillary Clinton lost and would probably herself in part blame people who on the left didn't come out to vote for her. Maybe they supported Bernie Sanders in the primary. This time around, do the Democrats appear to be more united?
United, yes, and perhaps a little more fired up, a little bit more like they were in 2008 and to some degree in 2012. More enthusiastic than in Hillary Clinton's round. There's always some static. This convention has been criticized for being too light on progressives. There was too little time for AOC, Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez. Mm-hmm. Also, not enough prominence for young people and Hispanics in general. Critical elements of the coalition and question marks in terms of turnout. So insofar as they have been neglected, that would seem an unforced error.
Ron, we know President Trump was watching last night. He tweeted angrily, it appeared, at least in all caps, several times during President Obama's speech. Do you think the Democrats are going to do the same thing next week? Not maybe in all caps, but will they be live tweeting the Republican convention trying to steal the attention away?
Some will be. Some will be. I sincerely doubt that it will take quite the same tone. But at this point, because as we were saying, the rules have changed, no longer do the parties step back and let the other party have their week. That's a relic of the past. And we can expect that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and a number of other prominent Democrats will be as visible and audible mm-hmm. as they can be, especially as the president counterattacks. Mm-hmm.
Ron Elving, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
A study released today shows that children may play a larger role in the community spread of COVID-19 than previously thought. The research by Massachusetts General Hospital measured viral loads among symptomatic and asymptomatic children. Let's bring in Dr. Lael Yonker. She's director of the hospital's Cystic Fibrosis Center and lead author on the study published in the Journal of Pediatrics. Dr. Yonker, you all tested 192 children, and more than a quarter were tested positive. How did you conduct the study, and were the results a surprise?
Sure. So we enrolled children who presented to the urgent care clinic for testing for COVID or exposure to COVID, or children who are hospitalized with symptoms concerning COVID or the late inflammatory illness that's seen in children. And what surprised us the most was that children carried very high viral loads in their airway secretions, loads that were higher than adults who are hospitalized for their severe COVID illness.
Does that high viral load relate to the ability to spread? Because if the two are correlated, then kids would be transmitting the virus even more efficiently than adults?
In general, for respiratory viruses, the higher viral load that you have in your secretions, the more likely that virus is going to be passed along from one person to another, because viruses are transmitted through these respiratory droplets and secretions.
As I mentioned, the study includes about 192 children. Does this translate to the population at large?
So we were the centralized COVID screening center, had a large catchment area geographically and across a wide socioeconomic range. But it's hard to translate because, again, children, when they do get sick, generally have very mild symptoms or might be asymptomatic, which makes it harder to realize who is infected or who isn't. So it complicates the role that children are playing in the pandemic.
I want to go deeper on that because one of your co-authors notes that kids are also not immune from getting sick. It puts to rest the president's contention that kids are almost always immune. Your study also looked at multi-organ systemic infections that can occur as kids are recovering from COVID-19. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. So this illness is related to the inflammatory response that goes on well after the infection has been cleared. And that immune response is actually damaging to the body. And kids can get quite sick from this, develop cardiac issues, and end up in the intensive care unit. And we found that this response does seem to be related to the antibody response. So the body's actively fighting, building these immune responses, but the body builds these antibodies in an uncontrolled manner, and that seems to be harmful to these kids.
Doctor, this, of course, is significant right now because so many places in the country are going back to school. You all are contending that we should not rely on temperature and symptom checks. Can you explain that?
Exactly. Monitoring for symptoms or temperature checks are not a reliable way of identifying COVID. In our study, only 50% of the kids who had COVID reported a fever, and 50% of the kids who didn't have COVID reported fever. So fever was not an effective way of identifying COVID. Other symptoms were also equally distributed between kids who had COVID and who didn't. And it was just typical symptoms of colds or allergies.
So what are some of the other takeaways on this? I mean, what metrics do you think we need in place to open schools safely?
So I think what we've learned is that contrary to the initial reports and beliefs, children are not spared from the COVID pandemic. And in fact, they could play a significant role in contributing to the spread of disease. The policymakers, the people who are setting up the rules for how schools will safely be started, need to take this into consideration. And they need to consider enforcing mask wearing, social distancing, taking advantage of remote learning when possible. Pretty simple measures that can be done to make reentry into school safer.
And how closely should parents be monitoring kids who get sick? Because you note that COVID-19 in kids can sometimes be mistaken for a common cold or other childhood illnesses.
This is very tricky. So early identification of any symptoms should prompt monitoring and perhaps testing early on, because we do show that viral loads are highest in the first 2 days of illness. And then if there's any exposure to somebody who has confirmed COVID, that should also prompt testing, because we've shown that kids, after exposure to COVID, even before they develop any symptoms, if they develop symptoms, they can also have very high viral loads.
That's Massachusetts General Hospital's Dr. Lael Yonker, lead author of a new study about the spread of COVID-19 through children and the implications it carries for school reopenings. We'll post the study on our website at hereandnow.org. Dr. Yonker, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Emmys are coming up on September 20th, and the HBO show Succession got 18 nominations. The show centers around the Roys, a dysfunctional family that owns a media conglomerate. The patriarch, a la Rupert Murdoch, is played by Brian Cox, who was nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actor. Here he is in an episode talking with his son, played by Jeremy Strong.
Step up onto the rack. I'm going to pull you limb from limb like a piñata and see what falls out.
Okay, so you want what?
I want the game plan, what the timetable is, capital structure, end game, what they might accept, what their weak points are. But we'll start at the start. When did they approach you?
When did they approach me?
Mm-hmm. Did it take long, or did you open your legs on the first date?
Brian Cox joins me now. Welcome.
My pleasure. Nice to talk.
Well, and congratulations to you on this Emmy nomination. We should say you're not only up for an Emmy, you've also won a Golden Globe for playing Logan. And I wonder what it is like for you to get all this acclaim right now at this stage in your career, which has been a long career.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, really. But I was always told by a lot of people much wiser than me, usually older actors and directors, who said, well, you know, Brian, for you, it's going to be the long haul. Well, I thought it might be the long haul, but this has really been quite a long haul. It's not that I have any regrets. I've had a very good career. I've had a great career in the theater here in the UK, and I've had a equally great career in movies and subsequently in television. So it's all timed out rather well.
And what is it like for you to be up against, for the lead actor Emmy, up against your co-star, Jeremy Strong, who plays your son on Succession? Is there any competition there?
No, I just think it's poetic, really. Poetic in the sense that, you know, the conflict that goes on in the show and the father and son conflict, and it's sort of mirrored by the awards, you know. I'm quite sanguine about it, really, you know, because I've been around the pond too many times to actually, you know, I treat it with respect, but it's not my life's blood, you know what I mean?
Well, now the Roys, for people who know the show or don't know the show, have drawn a lot of comparisons to the Murdoch family. Obviously, yeah. In that case, you also have an aging patriarch that owns a media empire, including Fox News. I did see, by the way, when James Murdoch just left News Corporation, Rupert and Lachlan, that would be his father and his brother, put out a statement that said, "We're grateful to James for his many years of service to the company. We wish him the very best in his future endeavors." And I thought, God, it's like an episode of Succession.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the big difference is that, you know, Murdoch, Trump, Redstone's, it's all inherited. Murdoch inherited a newspaper business from his dad, With Logan, she's self-made. You know, it's all mm-hmm. he started with nothing, and so it's got a slightly different edge to it. So in a way, that puts a real spin on the relationship with his children, because in a way, he loves his children, but they are a consistent disappointment to him. They suffer from being entitled in a way, and they've lost touch with reality, which is very similar to what we're witnessing both with the Prime Minister of the UK and the President of America. So this is something that is very current, you know, and for those kids, that's what they've done. And that's really the angle that Jesse Armstrong, our genius writer, creator, has kind of come with. You know, that's where he's gone. He's moved in that direction. It actually opens up more possibilities in terms of the stories, in terms of the individuals and how the individuals survive and how they do they come to any kind of self-realization about their position.
What do you think it says that this show has gotten such acclaim and also been so popular with viewers at a time of such income inequality around the world, but especially in the United States?
I think that's the precise thing. Shakespeare's great adage is that, you know, in Hamlet's advice to the players, he talks about holding the mirror up to nature. And what Jesse has done, he's held the mirror up to a particular society that's been getting away with it for a very, very long time. And it's also about wealth, and it's about how wealth kind of inures you from everything else and makes you kind of live in a world which is a parallel universe to a certain extent. And I think it's true. I think we've witnessed it. We've certainly witnessed it with the Trump family. I mean, it's ridiculous. And certainly since publication of Mary Trump's book, you know, we've seen how dysfunctional things are and where that dysfunction comes from. So it's what we do. It's what human beings do. You know, we live in a very confused state, I think. I mean, there's my example of this is I went to a book launch in L.A. that I was invited to by the actress Rosanna Arquette. And it was a book launch for Ronan Farrow's Me Too, the second book. And I was there and watching it, and it was, you know, it was very full of a sort of ladies of a certain kind of, you know, the ladies who lunch, you know. But afterwards, I found myself surrounded by a lot of these women. And a couple of them, not all of them, but a couple did very quietly say to me, "Would you mind if I videoed you telling me to F off?" And I said, "What?" And I thought, that really epitomizes the state that we are in. You know, they could sit all afternoon and they could hear these amazing words of wisdom from Ronan Farrow and quite scary stuff and then come up with that. So people live in a kind of curious paradox. Mm-hmm. The paradox seems to get deeper and deeper and more wide, you know, the more you see it.
So just listening to you talk, by the way, you've mentioned Mary Trump's book. You've mentioned Ronan Farrow's book. Would it be fair to say that in your free time, when you are consuming media, that more of it is news and current affairs than entertainment?
Yeah, I mean, I balance it. You know, I've been watching a lot of great, I really have, lockdown has given me an opportunity to see a lot of great shows, you know, like Call My Agent, Dee Poisson, the French show, which is very, very funny. I'm aware, you know, that there is this atmosphere that we live in. There's this terrible thing that we've been dealing with and people are dealing with in America. And this whole thing of the Trump era, what we've been through and the kind of the increasing craziness of that and the increasing kind of lack of realities. And it's no good. You know, we need moral authority. We need leadership. And we haven't got it. And of course, our show is exemplifying that and saying, look, this is what happened. It's also very entertaining as well. You know, it's funny, mm-hmm. it's entertaining, it's witty. And it's like a restoration comedy. You know, it's like a comedy of manners that we're seeing. This is the modern way. This is how people exist now.
Speaking of your show, the shooting of season 3, I understand, was delayed because of the pandemic. Do you have any sense of when that will resume and when the next season of Succession will come?
Yeah, it probably won't happen till the end of the year, probably not till November, but may not even be till the beginning of next year. I mean, I think what is great and what I really have some enormous respect and regard for HBO, because their protocols that they're putting in place, I mean, we've got a whole medical department now. We've got everything set up. And we will go when it's right to go. And we're going to go. I mean, the show is going to go. It's just that we will go at the right time and when everything is covered, you know, all bases are covered. So I suspect towards the end of the year, we will probably start, you know, putting on our socks to get ready to go.
And do you already know what's going to happen as this show continues, or is it a surprise to you when you look at the script?
Yes, I unfortunately do. All I know is, and now I can say, is it's very, very exciting. I mean, it's really even, I mean, I didn't think season two could, it would take a lot to top season two, but I think it's pretty amazing what, you know, the roller coaster ride that one is in for in season three.
Well, I have to say, after season two, now when I'm on a boat, I always ask, is this going to be a boat that's big enough and fancy enough where if you get an iPad and you look at it and you see something that you don't like, you can just throw the iPad over the side of the boat as somebody does in season two of Succession.
Yeah. I mean, it's, we live in kind of, it's a bit like the fall of the Roman Empire. We're kind of living in something where the political paradigm of the states and also here is shifting in a way that we have never really imagined. And it could be dangerous, but it also could be for the best. And I think we're going to see a whole different thing. This time next year, we'll be looking at be looking back and going, well, what was that we lived through? And where did it come to? And why did it come to this? And will we ever let that happen again? You know, I mean, there's nothing you can do about the virus, but there's a hell of a lot you can do about the other kind of virus, the one that's the political virus, you know?
That is Brian Cox, who plays Logan Roy on Succession. He is up for an Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Drama. The Emmys are coming up on September 20th. Brian Cox, a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much, and congratulations on your nomination.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. Thank you.
$1.1 million Americans filed new jobless claims last week, reversing a recent downward trend. But the stock market continues its climb unbothered, with the S&P 500 hitting an all-time high earlier this week. Just another sign of what some are calling the bifurcated economy. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, we've been talking to you each week about these unemployment claims, and they had been going down, but now heading back up. Do we know why?
Yeah, so we do know that the new influx of cases, we see a bit of a delay, right? Because people come back to work, then we find clusters of cases and we see them shutting down again. And with no sense of further relief, because there hasn't been a new bill issued, a lot of companies don't know what the future holds for them. A lot of states have not reopened. So we sort of expected to see a slight increase in the number of jobless and the number of new unemployment claims. What is fascinating, as you introduced, is the degree to which the losses on the stock market since the beginning of coronavirus have been entirely wiped out. But we're also seeing the effect of cities and states, which are running out of money, laying off people on a local basis. So those are the two worlds that we're living in right now.
Well, isn't part of the stock market story that the indexes that we look at, like the S&P 500, like the Dow, like the NASDAQ, include some of these stocks that have just been wildly shooting upward, like Apple and Amazon and Microsoft, and that kind of just changes the balance of what's going on with those indexes?
Yeah, I think that's completely right. They were all designed, these indexes, initially to represent American industry and how it looks, but they're heavily weighted toward technology, which has not nearly suffered. In fact, in many cases, has gained through the pandemic. The other problem is that corporations, because of the Federal Reserve, have really been able to benefit from the unlimited money that's been provided. Mm-hmm. The combination of low interest rates has made it easy for them to borrow. And because the Federal Reserve wanted to avoid the credit freeze up really of 2008, they've sort of said that banks will continue to be able to loan money to companies, and the Federal Reserve will provide that money. So as a result, companies have been able to borrow and keep on going in a way that individuals have not, which is one of the reasons the stock market is going up as much as it is. It's also the only game in town, because interest rates are so low that for people who invest professionally, they can't put their money into interest-bearing investments.
Yeah, and amazingly, one of the companies that's benefited from that Fed program is Apple. But my question to you now is, do you think that because the stock market is rising, it's going to make it less likely that Congress says, wait a minute, we got 20-some million unemployed people in this country, we have to pass more relief for them?
I think it muddies the waters. I think if you're of a certain age, you still associate the stock market with being a barometer of the economy. And we've seen a lot of people posting, look at that, the American comeback, the stock market is back to where it was. If you recognize that the stock market is not a barometer of the economy, and that you can accept the fact that the stock market is at record levels and it's not actually helping a whole lot of individual Americans who aren't working, then you would take seriously another bill. But at the moment, there is pressure not to have that bill, because some people are looking at this saying, what's the problem? Everything seems to be fine.
10 seconds here, Ali. Do you think Congress will pass something else before the election?
I think they will. I think the pressure is very heavy on them to do so. So it'll take some time, but it'll get done.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thank you.
My pleasure.
This week, presidential hopeful Joe Biden unveiled a $775 billion proposal that, if elected, includes expanding pre-kindergarten programs for families that can't afford private preschool. A handful of states already offer universal pre-K, and all of those programs have been hit hard by the pandemic and now face uncertainty about how to reopen. This adds to the misery that millions of parents around the country are struggling with right now when it comes to educating their children. Ebony Howard is the managing researcher on early childhood development at the American Institutes for Research, and she joins us now via Skype. And Ebony, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So many cities in the country are now offering free pre-K programs. In 2014, folks might remember New York City started a free program available to all four-year-olds in the city, and they're planning to expand that to include all three-year-olds, and so is Washington, D.C. But before we get to how the pandemic is impacting these programs, Ebony, can you lay out for us how widespread these publicly funded programs are?
Yeah, around the country, there's been great expansion of publicly funded preschool programs, particularly those in school districts. I say that has been growing over the last 10 years, but it's stagnated in the last few years. Many states and cities have publicly funded pre-K programs, but they still only support or provide access to the top states, 50%. Or more of the eligible four-year-olds, if you're thinking about four-year-olds, and even less for three-year-olds. But it is growing.
It's growing, and there's a reason why it's growing. There's a push to have kids start school earlier because it's seen as a benefit on their overall education. Can you tell us more about that?
Oh, yeah. There is a rich literature, a rich amount of research for decades about the positive impacts of early childhood experiences, specifically between the ages of 0 and 5. But 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds, early childhood experiences in preschool that start with them having a quality language-rich environment has had positive impacts on children's development, school readiness, language, social emotional behavior, and a lot of the foundational skills that you would want young children to have to be successful in elementary school.
How has the pandemic impacted these public preschool programs? We've been talking so much about school and school disruption and what school will look like in the coming school year.
Oh, there's no soft way to say it. It's been awful. It's barely been very hard. Schools, districts themselves either closed or tried to do a virtual platform of learning in the spring. Virtual online learning doesn't work very well for young children, ages four. You're thinking about four-year-olds sitting in front of a computer or a Chromebook or what have you. So it's really been pretty hard for the youngest kids. I mean, it's been hard for all kids of all ages, but definitely your three-year-olds and your four-year-olds who were in public preschool programs have been hit. And there's been research recently that's just come out to look at what's the potential impact on children's learning with the pandemic and said set kids back 3 or 4 months in terms of lost learning opportunities. And that's just with the springtime action. We don't know yet, obviously, with the upcoming school year.
Right, because the whole purpose, as you kind of laid out for us, of these programs is to kind of lessen that gap in educational outcomes for children who don't typically have access to preschool. So it sounds like you're very concerned about the setbacks to all of this money that has been poured into these pre-K programs in cities throughout the country.
Yeah, it's affecting the public preschool programs, and it has a detrimental effect on the children, the teachers, families and parents of the kids, and particularly those who are most disadvantaged. So research showed that, you know, early childhood experiences, preschool programs are great for all kids, right? All kids, but particularly those who are more disadvantaged, lower income, less availability to additional resources, show the greatest gains, and the greatest gains over time. So it really was an effort, I think, with many states and the federal government even doing their U.S. preschool expansion grant several years ago to help to close the gap, the equity gap, between blacks and whites, low incomes, and those who had more resources. And now with the pandemic, you know, those who are most vulnerable are the ones who are most easily hit. They don't have as many alternative options or resources for alternative options as those families that may have more economic advantages or greater networks of support.
Sure. You know, I'm also thinking about for those who might be trying to open those preschool programs. I mean, the safety measures for reopening public preschools are hard to apply to such young children. I mean, how are some handling the reopening?
So it depends on the context of preschool programs. So in New York, as an example, in New York City, you have your public preschool programs in the school districts, but you also have them in community-based organizations or your YMCAs, for example, or your local small business owner who owns their childcare facility that offers preschool funded by public dollars. So in the schools, they're following the school guidance, right? So the school district guidance, and in many cities, they're saying virtual training, we'll give you technology, we're supporting you with internet, and then seeing how that guidelines work. That's not going to work for many young children at age four. So many families are choosing actually to go to those community-based organizations, which can offer not only the preschool opportunities, but also childcare. Because then the child has something to keep them all day, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. And in childcare settings have a little bit different COVID-19 guidance than school districts. Still social distancing, but the cleaning, the spacing, depending on the environment and the context of the organization, it varies quite a bit.
Ebony, what are some things that you're thinking deeply about and working within your organization to move forward as we go into the school year and we think about these young learners and the impact of being outside of school?
I'm really thinking a lot about the inequality that's going to be exacerbated by the pandemic. Those who have more resources are able to make, it's still difficult, but alternative choices. For example, going to a private school. I'm in the city of Chicago. More of the private schools are staying open for in-person learning because they have the space to do social distances. They have more staff to make sure kids don't get on top of each other. They have smaller classrooms. They might have a classroom that was originally only 12 or 16 kids to begin with versus public schools where they might have had 18, 20, 25, 40, depending on the location and the district and the state. So the inequality is exacerbating. So what are children who are of lower income? What are they doing? We don't know very much about it. We know a little bit more about well-resourced people right now than low-resource. They're most likely turning to family, friend, and neighbor care, and that could be safe for the children and emotionally supportive for the children, but it may not be academic for the children. So they may still have that academic lag, and that will be exacerbated. So thinking about the inequality issues is something that I personally have been thinking about, and American Institutes for Research is really been spending a lot of time thinking about this issue and how we can get more information, data, and solutions to help reduce the likelihood of those exacerbations.
Yeah, and the big conundrum right now is that there are no easy solutions.
No, I mean, I say, you know, I have friends and family, they know I'm an early childhood expert, and they'll ask me, what am I doing? I have a 2.5-year-old who was supposed to go to 3-year-old preschool this fall. So what are you doing and how are you dealing? And my answer is, every answer is right and every answer is wrong. We really don't have a solid base of research on the best solutions. And so right now we're kind of in this natural experiment, and most of us are thinking that it's all going to be bad, but, you know, we don't know. There could be possibilities of new learning, new opportunities for children's connections, new connections with families and homes in a way that wasn't before. There may also be more risk for certain families. And these are questions we don't have answers for. What are we, about 5 or 6 months in the United States in the pandemic here of it's impacting right. us? So it's really early to say, but it's definitely a lot of questions we're all struggling to answer.
Ebony Howard is managing researcher at the American Institutes for Research, focusing on early childhood development. Ebony, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
A University of Miami study of nearly 20,000 species this week shows that plants are shifting out of their natural habitats because of warmer temperatures, and in some places, native species are going extinct altogether for multiple reasons. In Pennsylvania, researchers are trying to save one native plant found only in the Appalachian Mountains that's threatened by an insect. The Allegheny Front's Andy Cubis went into the field with one scientist who's made saving that plant his mission.
Canby's mountain lover, scientific name Pachystema canbyi, is one of the rarest plants in Pennsylvania. Only a couple dozen people have ever even seen it growing in the wild.
This plant could go extinct. It's a really plausible outcome.
Steve Grund is a botanist with the Pennsylvania Natural Heritage Program. On a recent Saturday morning, I met up with Grund and a few volunteers in Bedford, Pennsylvania, the northern limit of the plant's range.
Why don't you go with us?
Okay. The Western Pennsylvania Conservancy bought this land, about 8 acres, from a private landowner in 1994, specifically to protect the Canby's mountain lover. Today it only grows in 3 spots in all of Pennsylvania. The plant is in danger because of an insect called a scale. It sucks nutrients from the plant, including water. The insect is here because of an invasive vine called the Asian bittersweet that serves as its host.
Oh, you guys are going to need some of this.
The crew grabbed their weapon for this mission, a highly refined oil mixed with water loaded up in a squirt bottle.
It basically suffocates the scales. When they hatch from the egg, they're in a form called crawlers. While they're in that stage, they're vulnerable to this oil.
We start walking several hundred yards uphill and into the edge of the forest. Pretty soon, we're up on a limestone cliff. It's about a 60-foot drop down and looks like the sort of place you'd find rock climbers.
So that flag marked where we started treating last time.
There are small hot pink flags scattered around, marking where the Canby's mountain lover is growing. It'd be very easy to walk right past it and never know you were so close to something so rare.
So here's the plant. It's a little shrub. It can get bigger than this, and it can kind of sprawl out.
The plant is evergreen, with little dark green leathery leaves. In the spring, it has tiny white flowers. Right now, it looks a little bit like rosemary.
Could you hand me my sprayer, please?
Grund gets down on the forest floor to get to work.
Let's see if we can find any crawlers on this plant here.
He puts on gloves and sprays the plant with the oil.
So what you do is you get a white piece of paper, and my field notebook works fine for that. You put it under the plant, then you flick it with your fingers.
Grun grabs a magnifying glass that he wears around his neck.
I'm not getting any crawlers. Maybe it's because I have the wrong glasses on.
It's not the glasses. It's the same thing at the next few plants he sprays. Nothing. And he thinks that's a good sign.
Maybe we timed it really well and got most of them last time.
Grun will be at this site all day, spraying and counting the plants. And he'll also come back two more times this summer. It's a lot of effort for one small plant. But Grun says a team of botanists, academics, park rangers, and citizens chose this one to focus on because there's something they can do.
Often I feel like my job is to document the demise of rare plants. Here we have a case where there's a chance that we can save these Pennsylvania populations and the rest of the range and hopefully keep it off the endangered species list.
And why do they care that this small plant might go extinct? One reason often used is that you never know what plant might contain the cure for cancer. But Grun says it's more than just what benefits humans.
You know, these things are all connected, and sometimes we know what those connections are, and often we don't. But I also think that a species has its own intrinsic value.
A value he and others believe is worth preserving. For Here and Now, I'm Andy Kubis.
Tourists known as heat chasers have been descending on Death Valley National Park this week after it hit a record of 130 degrees on Sunday. And if the heat wasn't enough excitement, visitors also felt a quick jolt yesterday from a magnitude 4.8 earthquake.
With this earthquake, if it had happened in the winter, it probably wouldn't get so much attention. But just because we've been having these hot temperatures too, it's saying, oh, hot and earthquakes? What other natural phenomena could happen this week?
That is Brandi Stewart, Education and Outreach Program Manager for Death Valley National Park. She says the visitor center there is closed because of COVID-19, but people are still driving out to take pictures to mark that record heat.
I spoke with a few people on Monday. There was a little bit of, I would say, a celebration happening in the afternoon at our display thermometer. And people were just excited to be there. And for a lot of people, I think it's a bucket list item for them.
And 130 degrees, by the way, feels exactly how you might think it does. Stewart compares it to opening a hot oven.
The park that I worked at before working here at Death Valley, I used to work at Mount Rainier National Park, and that's the second snowiest place on Earth. So it's very different going from doing visitor programs on 15 feet of snow and snowshoes to leading visitors on sand dunes to track animals.
By the way, Tanya, the heat wave appears to be subsiding. It's only forecast to be 121 degrees today in Death Valley. What about where you are in Southern California?
It was 97 degrees yesterday and humidity like 70%. So,
oh boy.
Yeah, it's hot.
All right. Well, hopefully it gets cooler soon. Here and Now, production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.